morning.
I'm glad you're awake. That's good. Welcome to session two of Living Word. My name is Paul Rohde. I'm campus pastor at Augustana University in Sioux Falls. And I want to say a special welcome to people who are here for the first time. I'll try to do a little recap at the beginning. I think it's good even for those of us who heard the discussion. We're working on the sibling rivalries in the book of Genesis. And listening to the stories to help us tell stories about our own siblings and also to help us think about living in a global world. There's wonderful resonance happening between the sessions. If you went to the session that Gary led yesterday, he's not only using the same book, but there's just tremendous overlap. And I went to the racism session. I want to go to all the sessions because they keep reinforcing these themes in terms of tension between people. People who study family systems will say that our family of origin is finally the only family that matters. And that we live out that role kind of in all the other places we go. So that I think it's really valid for us to be starting with thinking about our own families, who we are in our sibling groups. Or, I said yesterday, if you don't have siblings, helping those of us see more objectively. What do you see going on? Or thinking about friendships and the way those form. I really appreciated your participation yesterday. There are a couple more insights after class. I'll do my best to leave enough time for discussion so you can share those with everyone. But there was some question about the other account of Hagar-Sarah. It's in chapter 16, where the conflict already starts during Hagar's pregnancy, where she looks, it says, with contempt on Sarah. And she, in fact, flees in that account, so it's told a little differently. We chose the chapter 21 one because it's the one that Sachs uses, and because it parallels 22, and it helped us think about Isaac and Ishmael. So the takeaway from yesterday was to be listening to the sweep of the text so that we hear not only the narrative is that Isaac is the chosen descendant, though he is younger. We had that birth order discussion going on, and that will happen again today. The counter-narrative is though Ishmael is not chosen, he is not rejected. He is blessed, he is sustained, he becomes the father of many peoples, and at Abraham's death, he and Isaac stand side by side, which is not often how we have lived or interpreted our chosenness. And we're going to get to that on Thursday when we think about Christianity in relationship to other faiths. Brad also had a great comment emphasizing the role of women in the ancient world and how that would have intensified Hagar's plight. Well, in a way, both Hagar and Sarah's plight. Sarah because of her infertility, and Hagar because she is hopeless to be a single mother in the wilderness. It really is a very desperate thing. So if you have comments, questions, that kind of thing, don't hesitate to bring those up. I'm not going to do a show of hands again today, but yesterday we were overwhelmingly firstborn children in the room, like something like two-thirds of the people here. It's so firstborn, you know, to be up and at the first session. And I had great fun in a conversation yesterday speculating where we could take the Bible study so that other birth orders would be prominent. You know, what would happen if we did the Bible study on the smoking porch? Right? It would probably be a totally different discussion. I get to do this twice, and I'm eager to hear how it's different next week, because I think different groups will bring different things to it. But I decided, for the sake of fairness, to tell a youngest birth order story today. I told you I love to teach confirmation. I was teaching a group of confirmants. It's the first session. These are eighth graders. And they're going around the room and introducing themselves by name and some prompts about what they do for fun and just to get acquainted kind of thing. And Stacy introduced herself, said, "My name is Stacy. I am the oldest of twins by 4 minutes. So I consider myself a middle child." I said, "What do you know about being a middle child?" Well, she knew quite a bit about being a middle child. And she felt like it fit her, and she was laying claim to that. So then I said, how many of the rest of you have old children? I don't know that there were any others in the room. I said, how many of your oldest children? Well, I think I was the only one. How many of you are youngest children? And all these hands went up, except for, you know, the middle child twin. I said, class, you know what this means? This means this class is going to be a lot of fun because youngest children know how to party. And they were high-fiving each other and fist-pumping each other. And the class was a lot of fun. I mean, so how many youngest children do we have? Yay, help us have fun. Okay, good. A good representation of youngest children. And, I mean, it's fascinating in these texts. You will be interested in this youngest children. How youngest children claim power and are given power and blessing. Isaac was the second born, but is the inheritor of the covenant to Abraham. So, how many people in the room have said either of these things? Why can't you kids just get along? Or I could have killed him. Yeah, all right, good. So the life and death implications of Cain and Abel. I love this graphic. Probably should have put it on the Bible thing. We're going to hear that Abram's sacrifice was accepted. We've got God here with kind of a propane torch, you know, lighting the sacrifice, and Abel is all pious and in great shape. And here is Cain trying to get his sacrifice going. You know, and so he's blowing on the smoke, as every good camper knows, and it just blows back in his face. So create a little empathy for Cain. I put that, this is my brother, he's 2 years younger than I, and it was so fun to go back and look for pictures to prepare for this, because I honestly never remembered us holding hands. I think at Christmas, once a year, whether we needed to or not. So the story I was going to tell, there are other comments that have been made, and some of what we're after is not assuming we know what sibling rivalry is. I mean, what is it, and what do we learn about it from these stories? I tease my mom first I should tell you that our family had a tradition of going to our friends Elroy and Tressie's house for New Year's Day. And Elroy and Tressie had one grown son, he'd long out of the house, and their house looked like a house that hadn't hosted children for a long, long time. You know how those houses look, right? Beautiful things everywhere and everything in its place. So I teased my mom that my memories of our Advent ritual were them coaching us not to fight at Elroy and Tressie's. Somehow, after all of Advent and all of the coaching, Bruce and I would get through New Year's without fighting, and we'd have a fight in the car on the way home. Every time, you could count on it. So your prompt is, when you look back on fighting with your siblings or watching siblings fight, what do you think it was about? And what do you learn about yourself when you look back on that experience? So we're going to take 5 minutes, talk to each other, think about fighting with your sibling. If you never fought with your sibling, I guess you can have a moment of quiet reflection. So I would go ahead and just talk with each other. Okay. Let's come together. It's all right. You want to learn from each other. I just know you do. Deep down. So let's hear some stories. What do you think it's about? Fighting. How so?
You mentioned pecking order.
Right? Yeah.
Who's in charge?
It probably is about power.
Oh,
he's saying he thinks it's about power. Okay. That, and went back to what we said yesterday about the pecking order and the kind of sibling rivalries that exist even among chickens. Any other assertions? What it's about? Go ahead.
We said the same thing, and I was saying that I have twins. And so to establish a pecking order with twins, they're not 4 minutes apart, they're 20 minutes apart. And the one that's 20 minutes older, boy, is he older. You know, I mean, he will tell you. But that is very hard, that pecking order, especially with twins. Mm-hmm.
Well, I told you yesterday, when I was 9 or so, my brother got bigger than me, which made the pecking order. Others? Other stories? Reactions? Go ahead.
Well, I think similar but not quite the same is competing for the parents' attention.
Yeah.
And wanting regard in the parents' eyes, mm-hmm. or status in the parents' eyes.
She's talking about competition for parents' attention. And the gaze of the... to some extent, conflict is often about scarcity or a perception of scarcity, is it not? Go ahead.
I'm third of 10, but I have a sister that's 15 months older than I am. And she's probably the one that I basically fought with, although I did fight with my brothers also. But we always fought about who had to do the more work, because we lived on a farm, but the girls were inside doing the housework, helping mother take care of the younger children and the babies and all that. So what we fought about was who had to wash the dishes, who had to do whatever work, and it was always like, I always wanted to do the least work possible.
How many of you fought about chores? My brother and I did too. We both wanted to wash dishes because the person washing got done first. You know, the dryer took longer, so it was better to wash. So my parents came up with a system where I was firstborn, so on odd number days, I would wash, and on even number days, my brother would wash. And, you know, my brother's an engineer, but he never complained that there were more odd days than even days. In 31 day months, it wasn't necessarily fair. The other story I love to tell about my brother, my teddy bear, I still have it, and it was just about this big, a nice, soft, cuddly little teddy bear, right? Bruce's teddy bear had a molded rubber nose, and he would put his fingers around the legs of that teddy bear, and it was ammunition. I mean, he could haul off, and he hit me with that teddy bear. Power. we're gonna listen to the text. And hear what we think about here, and why the problems arise. Genesis chapter 4. We'll start with verse 1. Now the man, that would be Adam, knew his wife, and she conceived and bore Cain, saying, I have produced a man with the help of the Lord. Next she bore his brother Abel. Now Abel was a keeper of sheep, and Cain, a tiller of the ground. Those could be really important details. I think they are important details. In the course of time, Cain brought to the Lord an offering of the fruit of the ground, and Abel, for his part, brought of the firstlings of his flock their fat portion. And the Lord had regard for Abel and his offering, but for Cain and his offering he had no regard. So Cain was angry, and his countenance fell. The Lord said to Cain, why are you angry, and why has your countenance fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin is lurking at the door. Its desire is for you, but you must master it. Okay, I would call myself a narrative theologian, and by that I mean... narrative structure, but the importance of the way we describe something and what we call something. You know, Adam's first task in the garden was to name the creation, and I think how you name it really matters. So is this a struggle of power? I mean, if Abel's gift is regarded and Cain's is not, that is a diminishment of Cain, or maybe Cain feels it as a diminishment, you think? Or is it a matter of gifts, that a lamb is somehow a better offering than a grain offering? I mean, you think about the way the conflict works in your family and giftedness. Children have different gifts, and they're always comparing themselves to each other. We were with our youngest daughter before we came here. She lives in Tacoma, and sort of out of the blue, she said to us, which of my sisters do you think I'm more alike? And I said, Inga, why does that matter? You're different from either of your sisters. and like both of them in some ways. Why, you know, why this comparison? But her life was about comparing herself to her sisters, and she did a really good job of it. Like, she could keep up, even though she's 5 years younger than her older sister. The reason I think that the details are important about Abel being a keeper of the flock, a herder, and Cain a tiller of the ground, the tiller reaper, is to think about the tension between this function. I mean, in ancient history, this may be a comment about the development of agriculture and how initially people were tending flocks, they were nomadic. But when people start tilling the ground, there is less grazing land for the flocks, A, and the people who are tilling the ground don't want flocks grazing on their crops, right? So you've got this kind of tension brewing. More recently, I told you I'm from South Dakota, so that history is played out vividly, where the Sioux, Lakota peoples roamed and followed the buffalo and lived off wild animals and the land. They were hunter-gatherers. But when Europeans came and started plotting the land, they got increasingly marginalized, and it was very literally about space. And is there space for both? And I want us to be thinking about how much space gets left. Now, I saw a hand back there.
I've also been told from this that Abel's offering was first fruits, so to speak. Cain's offerings were an offering, but not first fruits.
But not the first fruit.
It's a matter of, you know, we give from the beginning, not from leftovers. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But that's not the text. The text doesn't make that evaluation.
Well, I'm saying I heard the evaluation.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
You're right.
I'm not saying
but the text itself, the story itself does not make that evaluation.
Yeah.
The firstlings
of his flock. Yeah, so it's another one of those arguments from silence in a way.
Yeah.
Did he bring the first of the grain or not?
I don't
think
know. I'm just saying
whether or not it's in the text, it's in life.
Yeah.
Are you doing your best? Is somebody doing their best, or does somebody sloughing off and getting it easier? Mm-hmm. You know, there are these kinds of comparisons that get made.
There's a harvest time. I mean, the time of harvest is different too. Lambs are in the spring.
Right.
And the grain's going to be harvested later in the summer, depending on...
Yeah, though less so in Israel, because it's closer to the equator. So plants are planted in the winter, and there's harvest in the spring. Summer is too hot for things to grow. I don't know, that may affect the breeding cycle, though. You may be onto something. Any other comments about this tension? Go ahead.
Oh, well... It's a comment on the text, and then it's the Lord who plays favorites. I have a lot of trouble with that, and maybe you're going to get to that.
Well, we are going to get to that. What do you think about that?
I still wonder why
What's
God was talking
to
everybody.
Oh, I'm sorry. The question is that it was the Lord who claimed one offering, you know, the favoritism.
It wasn't like the Adam had done that, the father. I mean, you can understand that, but the Lord...
Or Eve, you could understand Eve doing it.
But
the Lord, yeah. Okay, so what do you make of it?
I'm still confused about all the Old Testament when, like you mentioned yesterday, you never felt like you'd heard God's voice directly.
Yes.
What the heck was going on in the Old Testament where he had a megaphone and now it's all just super subtle with everything?
Yeah. Well, what I would say about that is the Old Testament is written and the writer has a voice. And the writer writes it in the voice of God. So it is the writer who writes
that. The
yeah.
lamb was more acceptable mm-hmm. than the grain.
Go ahead.
So I've just been listening to like some podcasts and reading some things. Like I read Rob Bell's What is the Bible recently.
Okay.
And so what I've like been thinking about this summer a lot is that the Bible is like an ongoing conversation between people and God, right? So it's... It starts out with people in this system where you have to be appeasing these gods that are scary all the time. And, like, because if you're not, then they're going to kill you or something. Like, something wrong is going to happen. And so this is kind of the beginning of the conversation. This is what I'm understanding this summer, if it's, I don't know, where I'm at. So like in the beginning, they're like working at what God's trying to pull people away from the system of like tit for tat kind of thing and like trading. And then like later on in a lot of places, it, God's just like, I'm going to give this to you and you don't have to give anything back. And it's kind of working towards this place where it then gets to the ultimate, like we don't have to do this anymore. Like this trading back and forth, you can just accept love. And so this is like the beginning of that conversation, in, like to what I understand.
I think that's very helpful. I mean, I really hear this passage about as a statement of the problem. It is stating the problem, and it's stating a variety of problems. One is that some gifts are acceptable or some gifts are better. This is part of the problem, and this is going to get violent very quickly. It's really a stunning comment that this is the first act of worship in the Bible, and it is the first murder. And the first murder is a fratricide. And it comes just that fast. So what I think is happening is that it is stating the problem that people perceive that God favors others, and or that the parent favors them. And in some ways, in the eyes of a child, I think matters not. That somebody sees that somebody else is better. Okay, we've got hands all over the room. Go ahead.
It tells you the power of feeling rejected.
Doesn't it? Yeah, I didn't comment on the word countenance. Yeah, countenance is a fantastic word. It's sometimes translated face, but it really means more presence. This whole sense of who somebody is, and his countenance falls. It's a sense of a person crumbles. I mean, we call that breaking down. You know, it is a powerful statement about that. You had something you wanted to say.
Yeah, I was just wondering if the point being made in this passage should be...
Could you speak up a little?
Yes, I was just wondering if one of the points in this passage should be of a difference between equality of value and equality and not difference in labor. So to somehow,
equality of value and...
Equality of value in the eyes of God and value of work. So if God, for instance, had somehow would say that both works were equal, he would diminish that which is greater. But he never says that Cain is less valuable than Abel. In fact, he says... He basically is saying that don't let sin lure you into thinking you're less valuable.
Right. Right. I mean, in another way to say it's stating the problem is to say, how do you deal with disappointment? How do you deal with rejection? Sin is lurking at the door. What do we mean by sin here? When I say I think it's about space, I mean, you think about the way tilling the ground takes the space. And the grazer has no space left. So maybe God has regard for Abel means make sure there's some space for Abel. Or we heard it yesterday on the ecology hike, where there is all this evidence that the native peoples of the Northwest had fires. They deliberately started fires and would burn part of the fires to keep the forest healthy, as well as to move the livestock and to produce berries and all of the other kinds of things in fire ecology that comes. Then Europeans come with fire suppression. Well, these two things cannot coexist. I mean, and now the ecologists recognize that they need to burn the forest, have controlled burns, but people don't like the smoke. See, so it's my brother and I were drawing lines all the time. We shared a bed. We would draw a line in the middle of the bed. This is my space on the bed. We did it in the back seat of the car. Yes. This is my side of the back seat, you know. And one of the words that we've sort of lost about sin, but we've not lost it from the Lord's Prayer yet, is the word trespass. I think it's a marvelous word for taking somebody else's space. And or going in the suburbs, the way you experience it is when the neighbor has a dog they don't keep track of, and you get the doo-doo in your yard, right? And so it's going on to somebody else's territory. And in all of the sessions that I've been to, there is so much discussion about the systemic and critical way this continues to be a problem in our world, that we take somebody else's space. That we do not honor somebody else's space. And the violation then just intensifies. Is there more that we need to say, or shall we keep moving? We should keep moving. Because I've got some things from Sachs I want to share with you too. So, Verse 8. Cain said to his brother Abel, let us go out into the field. I'll meet you out back, right? And when they were in the field, Cain rose up against his brother Abel and killed him. So matter of fact, so without emotion, it's just there. Then the Lord said to Cain, where is your brother Abel? He said, I do not know. Am I my brother's keeper? Mm-hmm. Cain says that. I mean, that is such an important question. Love your neighbor is like love of God. Am I my brother's keeper? And who is my neighbor? I mean, these questions rattling through the village this week, it's really very significant. Am I my brother's keeper? I think, I'm glad he at least says the word brother. One of the verses that always challenges me as an older brother is the prodigal son story, where, you know, the older brother is all resentful about what the younger brother gets in that story. And he doesn't call him his brother. He says, this son of yours. When this son of yours came, it seems so cold and devoid of the sort of responsibility we have horizontally in faith as well as vertically. And the Lord said, what have you done? Listen, your brother's blood is crying out to me from the ground. And now you are cursed from the ground, which has opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When you till the ground, it will no longer yield to you its strength. You will be a fugitive and a wanderer on the earth. Cain said to the Lord, my punishment is greater than I can bear. Today you have driven me away from the soil, and I shall be hidden from your face. I shall be a fugitive and a wanderer on the earth, and anyone who meets me may kill me. Then the Lord said to him, not so. Whoever kills Cain will suffer a sevenfold vengeance. And the Lord put a mark on Cain so that no one who came upon him would kill him. Then Cain went away from the presence of the Lord and settled in the land of Nod, east of Eden. Now, there's a pattern in the text. It's one of the things I've not yet said about reading the Bible that I think is so important to say is that proof texting is very dangerous. Proof texting is when you take one verse out of the Bible and make it answer all the questions. So the first thing to say is that's very dangerous. We have to read in context, and we have to read the sweep. And what I'm saying is that I don't think this resolves anything. I do think it gives us great insight into the problem. Of not only of sibling rivalry, but of violence in the world, and why there is violence in the world, and where does violence come from, and that's what we're going to talk about next. Well, one of the things that I think is so there is this pattern in these texts called prehistory, where there is a violation. Adam and Eve eat the forbidden fruit and are banished from the Garden of Eden. There is always a consequence, and then there is always an act of mercy. So there's the violation, Cain kills Abel, there is the consequence, he can no longer till the ground, and then there is this act of mercy that he will not be killed. Okay, he's protected. The marvelous thing about this is that God will not be retributive. God will not get even. One of the verses that gets proof texted sometimes is an eye for an eye, which is a limited retribution. But Jesus will critique even limited retribution and in the Sermon on the Mount. And then there is limited generosity, and then there's overwhelming generosity. But so many times violence, Gary is saying, once violence is started in a culture, it's very difficult to stop. And why is it difficult to stop? Because there is so much getting even. How many siblings in the room were concerned about getting even? Getting even, getting back. Yes, we got two directions.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. And God will not kill in response to killing. And one of the ways of understanding Jesus' passion and death is to say that Jesus absorbed the violence and refused to return it. And it seems to me that some of the growth of, well, we've got three more days to talk about our growth, because there's tremendous movement in the story. So how the siblings come to be transformed and to acknowledge each other differently. I mean, there's no room for reconciliation here. Abel is dead. But there was a limited kind of reconciliation with Ishmael. At least he appears again. He's not gone. And then we're going to watch the transformation of Jacob and Rachel and Leah and Joseph as we move through the week. But I wanted to emphasize the business about retribution, because that's where I'm saying that this passage states the problem. Now, this it's not like... Is any comments or questions you want to make about this part of the text, please?
If Cain and Abel are Adam and Eve's first children, who are all these people that are going to kill Cain?
Yeah. Right. This section of Genesis is often called prehistory. It's not a historical document. And many ways, when they call Cain a tiller of the ground and Abel a keeper of flocks, I mean, they're representative of groups of people. They're narratives that they're more like parables than they are like factual history. And exactly right. And who is Cain going to marry? I mean, he's going to marry and procreate too. And so.
That's the next verse.
Yeah, exactly. It comes on real quick. So I do want, the thing that I want to do, I think we've talked about that. Okay, I'll put that up in a second. The thing that Rabbi Sacks does that I think is such a good example here is he's, remember yesterday, we're aiming for a theology of the other, starting with our siblings as others, but moving out toward implications of relating to all others. Okay, and so Sacks uses an evolutionary approach. He's working with evolution and how we evolved. And I think this is so fascinating. He starts by telling this story. I have weak eyes.
Just like Leah?
Something like that, yeah. Two friends are walking in the jungle when they hear the roar of a lion. The first starts thinking of places they can hide. The second puts on his running shoes. The first says, "What are you thinking of? You can't possibly run faster than a lion." The second replies, "I don't need to run faster than the lion. I just need to run faster than you." So the evolutionary question that Sacks is going to raise is, are we cooperative or competitive at the root? And what is the relationship between our altruism, our capacity to sacrifice for one another, to do great good, nobility, what is the relationship between that and the atrocities that we've already witnessed that from the very beginning happened? I'm going to just read a section of this because he develops the argument so carefully. The first man sees a collective solution. He tries to think of a way of saving both him and his friend. The second option opts for natural selection. He thinks of a solution that will save him at the cost of his friend. He knows that come what may, one of them will die, and he prefers it not be him. This is, in essence, the human dilemma. Which comes first, altruism or survival? The common good or individual self-interest? Are we under the skin, saints or sinners, angels or demons, moralists or Machiavellians? The joke trades on the fact that we are both. It's the central ambiguity of the human situation. Darwin's problem was this. If natural selection is correct, if evolution is a competition for scarce resources, such that only the best adapted survive and pass on their characteristics to the next generation, then we should expect to see the selfish survive. The altruists, those who take a risk for the safety of all, would on average die earlier and fail to pass their genes on. They are the ones who get eaten by the lion. As Darwin put it, the bravest, most self-sacrificial individuals would on average perish in larger numbers than others. And the noblest would often leave no offspring to inherit his noble nature. So altruism should become extinct over time. It's a bad survival strategy. Let others take the risk. Make sure you at least are safe. Yet Darwin knew that altruism was admired in every human society of which he was aware. Even animals take risks for the sake of the group. The one that emits a cry to warn of the presence of a predator helps the group escape while making its own detection more likely. In the language of today, how could selfish genes come together and produce selfless people? So he's going to go on to argue that survival of the fittest is based on cooperation, that cooperation is needed. This was reinforced by another book I read this summer. Our campus ministry summer read with faculty and staff was called Call to Community. And in the preface, the editor cited Margaret Mead, who asked the question, what is the first archaeological evidence of community? Want to guess what it is, the first archaeological evidence of community? What?
I'm guessing a container, maybe?
She's saying a container? No.
Human.
A what?
Medicine or healing.
Yeah, specifically, she said, a fossilized healed bone. Because a person with a broken bone couldn't gather their own food. But that they survived for the bone to heal is evidence that somebody got food for them. And here was the beginning of cooperation. And that we need to cooperate to survive. Go ahead.
I just watched a movie before I came that I've been recommending to people on Netflix called Sandstorm. And it's where cooperation, at least from our American point of view, may go too far. It's based in the Middle East, and it's a young woman that wants to break out of and the traditions of her tribe.
Yeah.
And that tribe, they were Bedouin, so the tribe traditions existed or developed probably for survival, but then it also crushes the individual.
Yeah.
And it's I would recommend it to anyone. It's a great movie called Sandstorm.
Okay.
So that's
good
where
to know.
We go.
Well, but we've got to hear the rest of it. So if cooperation is so essential for survival, why then violence? Where does violence come from? And Sachs is going to assert that it comes from the competition of groups, so that we're cooperative within groups, with people we are alike, but we're threatened by other groups, and hence this tension.
This was tension within the group.
Right.
Where she couldn't.
Yeah, well, there is always some of that, too. And I think for Americans, this is huge. I mean, he writes some very stunning things about individualism, about the West being the most individualized society the world has ever known. And I think how we're going to create cooperation and, more importantly, trust in groups in our culture is a huge question, even within groups, because we're so atomized at this moment. Go ahead.
There's a slight twist on that story that a number of, I'd say, illusionary writers are citing. There was a cartoon, I'm thinking of the lion, but although in the cartoon it was a saber-toothed tiger, and instead of putting on the tennis shoes and running, the guy put on the tennis shoes and went up and looked in his face, curious and interested, but that wasn't survival. So the editorial in the Post, St. Louis Post-Dispatch was basically trying to understand the distinction between progressives and more conservative notions, so that groups tend to survive, but they're not quite as curious. It's a little twist on...
Let's hear some more of Sachs. We cooperate and we compete. We cooperate in order to compete. One man will not survive against a lion, but 10 or 100 might if they formed an effective team. Their greatest danger would then be posed not by a predator, but by another human group in pursuit of the same scarce resources, food, shelter, and territory. It follows that we have two sets of instincts honed and refined by many centuries of evolutionary history. One set, Darwin's patriotism, fidelity, obedience, courage, and sympathy, inclines us in the direction of altruism. We work for the good of the group because our very viability depends on it. The other set, our most basic reactions of aggression, fear, anger, and combativeness, our willingness to fight and inflict injuries on others, shapes our relationship with rival groups.
What was that last line?
Shapes our relationship with rival groups. The other set, our most basic reactions of aggression, fear, And so I've got a different set of quotes than Gary shared yesterday. I mean, Gary documented the extent to which religion has been violent and the ways that religious certainty creates violent impulses. But Sachs also is going to argue that it is not religious belief that does so, it is our groupishness and our loyalty and what our loyalty to the group. And what makes religion so powerful, he says here, is that it is the most effective method we have found to create trust of strangers. Trust among strangers. And I mean, as much as there is great evidence out there not to trust clergy, I mean, I experienced this. I mean, I'm astonished at the kind of trust people will give someone when they find out you are a pastor. And even though you're a total stranger to them, that is still somehow acknowledged, largely. But I think this takes us back to Cain and Abel in a new way, to say, most of the farms I know have both livestock and tilling. Though not entirely. I mean, it depends on topography. If you've read Kathleen Norris, you know that she argues North and South Dakota should have been East and West Dakota, because culturally and topographically, they're more different that direction. The east is farms and the west is ranches.
Washington's the same way.
Yeah.
Only it's
the other
west,
way.
West is urban and then it's agricultural at the east.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So using this basic understanding, Sachs wants to challenge dualism. And dualism is what happens when cognitive dissonance becomes unbearable, when the world as it is simply too unlike the world as it should be. And then what do we do? We blame somebody else. Adam blamed Eve. You know, Eve blamed the serpent. Maybe Cain blamed Abel. That's not in the text. But make the other responsible. You know, my brother had curly hair. Still has curly hair. Very curly hair, and it was very cute, of course. So there, he would get a lot of attention. So I'm embarrassed to admit this, but one day I cut his curls off. It's like, you know, one of the things that I think sibling rivalry is about differentiation. You know, it's clarifying where self stops and other begins, and how to honor and appreciate the space of the other. And probably, I mean, I am an oldest, and I'll say that's been a hard thing for me to learn. I'm ready to talk about my space, and I can appreciate both the older brother and the prodigal son and Cain, though I've never wanted to kill my brother, I would say that. I mean, I would cut off his hair, but... So to take it back to that, dualism is that. And then he talks about the Bible's response. So now, I hope you will get enough of this book to want to read the book. I couldn't possibly do all of it. I mean, there are dualisms within Christianity and Judaism all along, and certainly there are dualisms around them, but largely they are rejected in the form of a deep monotheism that wants to hold good and bad in God. So the difference he will draw between monotheism and dualism is that the good and bad holds together in God. I've got that quote. I've got that quote here somewhere. It's the Isaiah quote, I make weal and I make woe. I think it's Isaiah 43. The Hebrew Bible is the supreme example of that rarest of phenomenon, a national literature of self-criticism. We saw some of this yesterday, where the descendants of Isaac are willing to be self-critical enough to tell the story of Ishmael. And I think it's what the racism workshop is calling for, it's what Gary is calling for, our capacity as Americans, as American Christians, to be self-critical. Now, he has a much more nuanced telling of this from a limited dualism to a pathological dualism. But a pathological dualism does three things. It makes you dehumanize, it's a British book, and I decided to keep the British spelling, okay? It makes you dehumanize and demonize your enemies. It leads you to see yourself as a victim, and it allows you to commit altruistic evil, killing in the name of God of life, hating in the name of the God of love, and practicing cruelty in the name of the God of compassion. This is what monotheism asks of its followers, to think of God as both a father and a judge. A judge punishes, a parent forgives. A judge enforces the law, a parent embodies love. God is both, but it's hard to think of both at the same time. A sibling is rivalry, and a sibling is gift, a huge gift. When you have aging parents, you don't want to face it alone. And the sibling is a great gift. Well, we were worried having the second baby if we would love her as much as we loved the first. I said to Susan, I really want to hold on to believing we are giving them a gift. So the root of a theology of the other is to believe that the other is gift, that the other is child of God. And while there is both weal and woe in this great movement, and we're going to go now to see options for this transformation, where Jacob, another younger, is going to cheat Esau out of everything he possibly can. And what makes that really frustrating is he prospers. I mean, he's good at it, and he gets rich, and it all goes well. But then we're going to watch that change. And hear how the text tells the story. And there's enormous transformation that will happen in the Joseph story. And enormous compassion in the Rachel and Leah story first. And how that comes to be, and how do we name that, and what will that do for us in thinking about our own families and our neighbors as sisters and brothers? That's where we're going. So, you know, what do we do with individualism in the West, and what does this contribute to our understanding of religious conflict and our relationships with people of other or no faith? One of the things that Sacks documents is that atheist violence has killed more people than religious violence in the Soviet Union, and the kind of genocide that happened in Cambodia and Rwanda, and that these were motivated by secular movements. They're not, so he will say, it's not religion that's violent, it's violence that's religious. Mm-hmm. And that in the name of God, then you see the other as totally evil and self as totally victim, which is both an abnegation of your own power and an absolutization, of your own power. So I do think it's an important groundwork for knowing we're capable of both cooperation and competition, and we've all got that going on. And it helps me understand why the Bible would tell the story in terms of siblings. Now, we've got just a few minutes for questions, comments, additions. Good.
I think violence against women, however, which is worldwide a problem, has deep roots in most religious traditions.
Yeah.
I mean, it's quite literal, and it's there, and it's the patriarchal constructs that worldwide, perhaps no problem is deeper than the divide between male and female.
Yeah.
And no end to the suffering and evil and sin that results from patriarchal religion.
Yeah. Thank you. And even though the Bible is very critical of it in many places, it needs to be critical again and again and again and again, you know. I appreciated the quote in the racism workshop about racism can be ameliorated, but its effects will always be there. And I think we need to believe that of sexism too, that it can be ameliorated, but it is a violation that is done in the name of religion and endorsed by religion, and is a limitation of the other, the face of God in the other.
In the name of God.
In the name of God, yeah. And another illustration of why language really matters, because part of the problem is that we have called God He, as opposed to acknowledging that God transcends gender, creates the male and female alike in the image of God and capable of relating.
What's fascinating to me about the Hebrew Scriptures is the fact that they will put Ezra and Nehemiah in there, along with Jonah and the Book of Ruth, both probably written about the same times. Well, you know, and it's two voices. a very exclusivistic. Mm-hmm. We've got to take care of ourselves. We've got to establish our Jewish identity. And then, oh, there's Ruth, the great-grandmother of David, who is a Moabitess, who is an enemy of Israel.
Yeah.
And there's Jonah, who suddenly teaches you that, oh, God cares about Nineveh as much as he cares about his own people, the chosen people. And I think that's a marvelous ability that the Jewish scriptures have, that in the Hebrew Bible has, that we in Christians have separated. Yeah. We said, no, that's heretical. And no, you know, what's in that gospel is heretical, the gospel of Thomas, but what's in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John is fine.
Yeah.
We exclude. They seem to have a better, Jewish people seem to have a better understanding of that.
Yeah. Well, and I appreciate that Holden is renaming this Our Living Word. Because the other thing that's happened is we've calcified the word.
Yes.
You know, we've kind of made it absolute and taken it out of context and not seeing it as living and active. I'm interested in your reaction as we move through these days to the power of women in the rest of the texts. The women have a lot of power in these texts. And so it is a patriarchal text on some levels, but the women have a lot of power. Go ahead.
Just in thinking about this, both in terms of family and larger as a groups or even as a nation, thinking about the tension between the individual and group.
The
individual and the group.
Yeah.
I find that we're trapped in the sense of rugged individualism, you know, the surprising of it, which seems to be a dangerous bit of delusion. Individualism is useless if it's sitting on its own. It has to be embedded within the group, having use.
Yeah.
In the same way, the group is useless unless it has the individual, and it's able to build on that diversity of gifts to make that thing function and be able to adapt in a changing world. So, you know, I'm looking forward to where you take the text, but it seems like being able to creatively use that tension and appreciation of the individual and its role within the group, and to be able to prize the gifts that they bring.
Yeah. Well, it's a combination of truth and mercy. Mm-hmm. Because not everything is gifts about other groups, as not everything is gift about us. But to find ways to name that and work through that and stay in relationship with that. Yeah. Tomorrow we will talk very much about polarization. As it happens in the text and as it's happened in history and as it is happening in this moment in our own country. So somebody asked me to give you the prompts of the... So tomorrow we're going to... I debated between an ugly verse and a happy verse. To prompt the problem, but Jacob, you know, Jacob who cheats his brother out of everything, he is a cheater and a grabber, gets it all, gives it back. Amazing story. And we'll have fun reading about how to get there. But do you remember times you got astonishing gifts from your siblings? And have you had moments of reconciliation? And what preceded them? That will be, so you can think about that. And then we'll start talking about that tomorrow and read the story of Jacob and Esau. Thank you for the day. Have a good day.